Log Talk Radio.
Me and Down the Tube, Really Random Stuff, is brought to you by a team of voices. A team of voices is a group located on allpoetry.com, the largest poetry site in the world. And we always like to say thank you to Kevin and his crew for keeping this site up and running and giving us a place to share our poetry. And of course, I always like to say thank you to Deborah Lee for running the group and blog talk page so we can share live. It's easy to join. It's free to join all poetry. Just head on over and knock on the door to a team of voices, and then you can see all the links and the poetry and join in yourself and join in the fun. I think that's about it. We are talking really random stuff, as always. And tonight, I will get into our topics in a little bit, but I want to talk a little bit about the opening song. Of course, it was pure imagination, but it was a cover by a band that I loved in my youth. They are called The Smoking Popes. And a little bit about The Smoking Popes. In 1990, the Cadier brothers formed a punk trio called Speed Stick with Josh on vocal guitar, Eli on brass, and Matt on drums. They played one gig in a friend's basement, after which the Cadier parents decided that Eli, then a sophomore in high school, would have to quit the band until after he graduated. So Matt switched to bass, and Dave Martins joined the drums. That summer, at their first self-funded recording session, the trio recorded about 15 original songs composed by Josh, some of them would form the basis of the Smoking Popes early material. So they're kind of like a underground fan. Not a lot of people know about them. I remember when strawberries used to be a thing. I don't know if anybody remembers strawberries, but you used to have to actually go to the store and buy CDs. But we used to do that. And I remember when I went into went into strawberries, I would ask, oh, do you have this album? Do you have this album? And they would always, most of the time, have to special order me what I wanted because they didn't carry it in the store because it wasn't very well known. This was one of those things. They had to special order me their CDs. But they're a great band. Check them out. And I hope you enjoyed the opening song. And without further ado, we have on the line, hello, Raconteur.
What's up?
How's it going?
Oh, let's roll those dice and see. It's going good.
Going good? A nat 20 or like 17 or like a 12? Like what are we? What's good? What
is your 18.00?
All right. Well, that's good. That's good. Yeah. So a lot of people have different views on covers, and you could be honest with me. What did you think?
That was cool. You know, the other song, the original version I heard from Willy Wonka. I don't know if that one was a cover or not, but you know that was where I first heard that song, and I just his voice. You know, my brain latches onto to it, so I'll always hear it in that tone. So it's different.
Yeah.
To listen to it. But you know, with the backing and everything, it's still cool. You know, that's I think what makes a good band is the composition of a song. When somebody can cover it and it doesn't sound garbage, you know, that means you know they did a good job with it. You know, I've heard a couple of bands that did that I didn't like the original, but when somebody covered it, I'm like, see, now that makes me like the song, and it makes me look at the band differently because, you know, wow, if they could play it and I like their interpretation of it, then, you know, let me go back and look at that. And then there's some songs that are just, you know, iconic, but, you know, the thing that comes to mind more than anything is Sounds of Silence. Simon and Garfunkel covered that, and that was like, you know, worldwide hit and everything else. And then what's his name from Disturbed?
Disturbed, yeah, Disturbed.
Well, he covered it, and everyone fell in love with his version too. So it's like, you know, it's still, you know, you got to give the nod to Simon and Garfunkel, but at the same time, it's like, you know, the material itself, you know, carries its own weight.
Yeah, I really love the Disturbed. I mean, I love Simon and Garfunkel. I actually have that on vinyl. So I really love it, actually. But I also really love the Disturbed. Plus, I just love Disturbed. Actually, I don't know. You might not know this because, you know, I don't think you look at the site very often. But on my, yeah, I mean, I love you, man. On you know, on the front page, you can say, like, when you go to, like, one of your poems, you have, like, this quote that stays up there. You know, when you join,
yep.
And it says, what's your quote, or it says whatever. I actually have a quote by Disturbed, and it's been on my thing ever since I joined, and it was, I might as well read it, right? Right here. When twilight draws near, when you are pushed to the very limits of your soul, when it seems that all you have left are the dead remnants of the fabric of your life, believe. And I just love that quote, and it was a Disturbed quote, and I just love Disturbed. So, yeah, and I know what you mean too about liking something. So, you know, often I'm like, this is really good, but of course I like the original better. But there is a song that I hate. And I don't know if hate's a really strong word. No, I really hate this song. And it is, so, who is it that does the original? And I think it was just a ripoff, but what's Machine? Something in the Machine.
The Machine?
I love her. I don't know. No, Something in Machine, and now I can't remember. And I love her. I love her. I don't know why I can't think of it. But what I'm going to do is, she wrote this song called Florence and the Machine, right? Florence and the Machine. She has this song called Shake It Out, and it's one of my favorite songs. I love the song. So when the song came out, Shake It Off, I was like, this is really kind of close to, you know, not anything in the lyrics, but just the hook of it, right? Except it wasn't Shake It Out, it was Shake It Off, but the hook was, to me, it was a little too similar. And the context of the whole rest of the song was not the same. But anyway, I don't really like Shake It Off. I do not like that song, and it makes me cringe. And I don't mind Taylor Swift, because I do like Taylor Swift. There's a lot of songs I do like her by her. But that song, it makes me cringe a little bit. And I heard a cover, and I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. So I agree with you that sometimes you can listen to a song and be like, oh, this isn't so bad.
That speaks to the composition, the writer. If it stands on its own, you know, okay, it's a good song.
Well, I think it was they changed the... I mean, I still don't really connect a lot to the words, but they changed the tempo, and it wasn't like... I don't know what they did. They changed the tempo and the way that it was sung. You know, like when they do... they have those jazz versions of a lot of things now, the jukebox jazz, and they take, like... I mean, they took... they just take really any song, and they make it into jazz, and it's pretty cool. But they changed the arrangement of the music around so much that it didn't grit my teeth, so to speak. That's horrible to say. I hate to say it, but it's true. It's true. Okay, so I have three topics. Of course, we have giant deer, right? I'm going to save and then we have the time it rained for 2 million years. And then we have the other giant animal, which I can't even do right now. I'm going to take it one at a time. So there we go. That's it. Before I forget, Iraq, I don't know if at any point you have a poem, you could let me know, and I will, and a lot of stuff is already loaded in the studio, I believe, here, right? So anytime if something pops up and you're like, oh, hey, this is mildly related, that's cool. So whatever you want, we'll put in there, okay? And
well, you said you like Bambi, so.
I read that. I did, and I take it back. I love it, but it's R-rated. I read it, and I was going to put it in there. But then as I was reading it, I was like, oh, this is,
okay.
This is not quite. I don't remember it being R-rated. But then when I was reading it, I was like, oh.
17.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, dear.
Exactly. All right. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play. I have three clips for tonight, and they are on the topics that I have. I'm going to play my first clip, and then we'll do a poem. And then I know I promised you to let you know what game I was playing today, so we'll get to that as well. And we'll go there. So I'm going to go with, when giant hyper carnivores prowled the earth. And I don't know why, I just really have an affinity for huge animals. Like, we would be dead. We would be dead in these times, and I just love it. I'm not that we, I don't love that we would be dead. I just love the idea. So this is Simbakuwaba, okay? I don't even know. That's just crazy. And it, 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 it's Yeah, it's just amazing. So you guys can take a look. You know, the information is provided by PBS, so it's public broadcast. So we're going to go ahead and play it. And then we can chat a little bit and drop our first poem. So here you go. And I'm going to press play.
We'd like to thank Raycon Wireless Earphones for supporting PBS.
In 2013, a researcher working in the vast collections of the National Museums of Kenya made a surprising discovery. Tucked away in a cabinet marked hyenas, he noticed a large fossilized lower jawbone from some kind of carnivore. And it was big, much bigger than the jawbone of a lion, the largest carnivore in Africa today. 6 years later, it was revealed to the public as an enormous beast that was completely new to science. It was named Simba Kuba Kutoko Africa. And while its name literally means big lion from Africa in Swahili, this creature was not a big cat. And even though it was found in a drawer labeled hyenas, it was not a hyena either. It was a hyenodont, an extinct family of carnivorous mammals that lived from the Paleocene to the Miocene epoch, and it lived in Africa, Europe, Asia, and North America. But Simba Kuba was not only unique because of its large size. The fossil jawbone was excavated in the late 1970s at a site called Meswa Bridge in western Kenya that dates back to about 26 million to 23 million years ago. It was from this jawbone that researchers were able to estimate a range of potential body sizes for Simba Kuba based on the size of its molars and comparisons to living carnivores. And it looks like, at its smallest, Simba Kuba was probably the size of a large lion. And at its largest, it could have been larger than a polar bear. And it was a hypercarnivore, meaning that it got more than 70% of its calories from meat. Based on its age and its monstrous size, Simba Kuba is the oldest known giant member of its subfamily of hyenodonts. These hyenodonts gave the world some of its largest terrestrial carnivorous mammals ever known. And while these behemoths were the apex predators of their time, they're not around anymore. It turns out that becoming the biggest, baddest beast on the landscape can have serious consequences when that landscape suddenly changes. Hyenodonts are members of an extinct order of carnivorous mammals called the Creodonts. And even though they were super carnivorous, Creodonts evolved independently from the order Carnivora, which includes all modern felids, canids, and other critters. Creodonts are older and more primitive than Carnivora, and they look different too. Their skulls were low with small brain cases, and their limbs were generally short and heavy. Early on in their evolutionary history, about 65 million years ago, the Creodonts branched into two lineages, one of which was the Hyenodonts. But the exact place they arose is still kind of a mystery. Some experts think they originated in Africa, others say Asia, and some suggest both, with a distinct group of Hyenodonts evolving on each of the two continents. But the fossils and the phylogenetic evidence we have seem to suggest that they arose somewhere in Eurasia. And Simba Kuba was part of a subfamily called Hyenalurinae. This particular group probably originated in the region known as Afro-Arabia, which includes the whole Arabian Peninsula and northern Africa around 48 million years ago. From there, they spread into Europe, Asia, and North America, where their large size and powerful bite ensured their position at the top of the food chain. But by the Middle Oligocene, roughly 30 million years ago, it looks like they went extinct on the northern continents, maybe due to competition from other groups of carnivores that evolved during that time. But in Afro-Arabia, they persisted, evolving in isolation, separated from the newly evolved carnivores in Eurasia by a seaway. And this isolation could have contributed to the rise of giant hyenodonts like Simba Kuba, because it wasn't until the early Miocene, around 23 million years ago, that evidence of the largest members of this group appeared, approaching the size of modern-day rhinoceros. What we know about Simba Kuba and its close relatives comes from a very fragmentary fossil record, which is mostly made up of dental remains and a few bones from the rest of the skeleton. This limited fossil record has made it hard to figure out what their family tree or even they themselves looked like. What we do know from their teeth is that these hypercarnivores had to be able to process a lot of meat, which they did with specialized teeth called carnassials. These are modified premolars and molars with self-sharpening edges that pass by each other in a shearing motion, like a pair of scissors. Now, living carnivores usually only have one set of these scissor-like teeth, but Simba Kuba and its relatives had three, turning their jaws into meat-slicing machines, but making sense of the rest of their anatomy is kind of hard.
In order to sink those teeth into all that meat, they had to catch it first. So researchers are really interested in figuring out how these giant predators moved around. And the one clue we have about Simbacuba's locomotion is pretty intriguing. Many modern carnivores are digitigrade walkers. This means that they walk on their toes with their heels in the air, making them faster than plantigrade walkers like us who walk with the soles of their feet flat on the ground. Digitigrade carnivores are more common in open grassland environments, where that posture helps them save energy and increases their stealth, speed, and hunting success. And Simbacuba's well-preserved heel bone, called the calcaneum, was similar to that of one of its relatives, which has been reconstructed as semi-digitigrade, not all the way up on its toes, but not totally flat-footed either. Researchers also think that relative was capable of making powerful leaps. So based on similarities between the two heel bones, it's possible that Simbacuba was also semi-digitigrade, making it faster and a more agile hunter. All of these advantages, a large body, three sets of meat-slicing teeth, and the ability to get around quickly, probably led to the success and survival of the hyaenodonts through the Miocene epoch. They likely hunted really large herbivores, like the relatives of modern elephants and rhinos, occupying a niche that remains vacant today. But if they were such powerful beasts that were so well adapted to their ancient landscapes, then why aren't they still around? Well, the hyaenodonts met their demise by the end of the Miocene, around 5 million years ago, thanks to an even more powerful force, a rapidly changing environment. This period of change started back around 23 million years ago, as the Arabian Peninsula approached Eurasia, closing the seaway that had kept Simbacuba and its relatives separated from the carnivores of Eurasia. From then on, waves of animals were able to migrate back and forth between the two regions. And among these migrants were hyaenodonts from Afro-Arabia heading north and carnivorans from Eurasia heading into Africa. This exchange of animal populations happened at a time when Earth was undergoing major changes, like the formation of the East Africa Rift System, where two parts of the African tectonic plate started to move away from each other. These changes led to dramatic transformations in the Afro-Arabian landscape, with forests becoming drier and turning into more open habitats. All of these changes spelled disaster for the hyaenodonts, but researchers are still trying to figure out exactly how. There are currently two hypotheses for the extinction of Simbacuba's group: changing food webs as environments changed and large herbivores disappeared, or competition from modern carnivorans. The first one suggests that when the environment started to change, it was bad news for the large herbivores that hyaenodonts relied on. Large herbivores tend to reproduce slowly, which can lead to a rapid decline in numbers if ecosystems change too quickly, because they can't adapt fast enough. Fewer large herbivores meant less food for the large hyaenodonts, which weren't adapted to hunting smaller prey. This would have made hyaenodonts more vulnerable to extinction than the smaller carnivorans, which had a broader diet. The second hypothesis involves competition from members of the order Carnivora as they moved from Eurasia into Afro-Arabia around 23 million years ago. Up to that point, hyaenodonts had been dominating the predatory niches in Afro-Arabia. Fossil evidence suggests that the earliest Afro-Arabian carnivorans were pretty small mesocarnivores, animals that get at least half of their calories from meat and the rest from other things. Think like raccoons or coyotes. And they're usually less dramatically affected by environmental changes than large hypercarnivores are. So as new carnivorans dispersed into Africa from Eurasia, they became more diverse and started to compete with the hyaenodonts. Plus, carnivorans with complex cooperative behaviors, like living in packs, may have been able to steal prey from lone hyaenodonts. Between the changing environment, lack of food, and the introduction of smart and sneaky competition, Simbacuba and its relatives might have simply met their match after succeeding on three continents for at least 15 million years. The evolution and extinction of these hypercarnivores offers rare insights into a time that saw massive changes in the climate, oceans, tectonic activity, and the dynamics of many ecosystems. And as more fossils are found, we may be able to recreate and better understand the African landscape in which they lived, which is also the landscape where our early ancestors evolved. Ultimately, the giant hyaenodonts of Africa serve as a stark reminder that even the most powerful beasts are no match for a changing world. Thanks to Raycon for supporting PBS Digital Studios. Raycon makes wireless earphones that come with Bluetooth pairing.
They gave a shout out in the beginning for PBS. So we have a caller. Hello, Deb. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. I was a little frazzled. But then I realized my phone was just awful. Because then I tried to call Rack, who was already on the line. And I was like, how did you get in? But then I wouldn't call him either. But we figured it out. I'm so happy. How is your weekend end?
Not too bad. Football season, so.
Rah, rah, rah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I got to integrate with people again. I mean, not that I mind so much being alone. But when I say people, I mean my godchildren and a couple close friends of mine, and my mom. So that was nice. So I don't know how much time you have, but I have you up there. And you picked a perfect time to call because you were just about to talk about the sim.
I noticed
the sim box.
About that one, so I thought, okay, that's good timing.
That was perfect timing, yeah. But do you think that there's a connection with the Simba Kabla?
I know, right? You got to wonder. I did wonder that when I saw it the first time and realized that it was a lion, and I wondered if that's where they got the name from. It would make sense,
Yeah, well, I didn't look that up, but, I think so. You have the mic already. It's already yours. And like always, you can talk about what you learned before, after. You can do it however you want. You have the floor.
Well, I had never heard of them before, like a lot of the stuff that you find and share with us. And I was blown away by how much bigger than, like, today's lions are. And I was just like, and they're scary. There's something about them. It's got for some reason to me it had like a rat face with a lion body, and it was like, oh, man. It just, like, I definitely would not want to meet him. That is for sure. And I did learn that it was the name lion in Swahili. I thought that was really cool. I can't even say it. Simba Kubwa. And I can't say the other one. Simba Kubwa Kutakaya. Means great lion of Africa. But like, I'm usually fascinated by the...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's cool to, like, just pull stuff out of your pocket. Like, hey, you know this thing? I think they're real, and especially when they're extinct and you're learning about where we are now and where we were, 23 million years ago. I just like it. I don't know. I'm glad you do, too.
Yeah, I have at least heard of the stuff that you share, but this time I hadn't, so I was like, I had to write about it. But this is called The Fossils of Simba Kubwa, the 23-million-year-old monster. And here we go. Tonight, we all meet a giant 23-million-year-old monster, weightlifting 600 to 3,300 pounds. The paw steps stomp. His mandible fossil is bigger than an armor breastplate, and a bite from his jaw can crush bones in one chomp. In a stance, his head passes man's waist height. This creature's a hunter and a scavenger, preying on rhinoceros and elephants. The head is huge with little beady eyes. Is this specimen like a dog or a giant cat, like a big roaring lion or a monster rat?
Excellent. I mean, I love I love what you put in here. I also love, like, there's so many different kinds of poetry, obviously. And I would say, you know, informational poetry category would be in this one. And I think, and this is just my opinion, I don't know if you're a folder kind of person. I feel like you should put all these rights in a folder. Because if you go back and you're like, holy, like, if someone wants to learn about all these random things, because I think you have written an informative piece every time. I can't ever remember you not writing an informative piece, an informational piece, but it's obviously poetry, but you also attach the pictures to it. And I know, like, some people might see it on all poetry and they're like, oh my gosh, why are there all these pictures and bits of information? But when you think about it, you know, poetry doesn't have to be a certain way. It doesn't have to be all lined. I mean, people have so many creative. You think about when people do the concrete poem and they make shapes, they do whatever. And this is such a consumable poem when it comes to this information. And I think it's just a great way to do it. And you know, and adding the pictures and cutting out the lines, yeah, it doesn't work. It's not like a traditional quote unquote poem where there's no pictures in between. But somebody can learn from this, and I mean, there's a place for this in this world. I totally believe it, and I love it because you don't overwhelm with information, but you do give the information, and it's fascinating. It's captivating in what you say. And when I come out of this, I think of praying on like, I like the fact that you decided to bring in, you know? Praying on rhinoceros is an elephant. If you're looking at something and you're saying, oh, okay, how formidable are they? And when you look at the size of rhinos and you look at the size of elephants and you're like, okay, this thing can take down elephants. Like, that's a big feat, right? I mean, that is not something to be messed with. I mean, elephants are huge. And you're giving us a scale of something that we know. So if you're just like, oh, they're this big and da-da-da, but when you start bringing in things that are more common and that you could relate to, you know, you're really giving the reader somewhere where they can stand. And when you're looking at, you know, the height and what it's going to be, I mean, you're giving a great visual into what these giant animals realistically look like and what they compare to things around us and to ourselves. So I love how you do that. I do think that a folder would be kind of cool. If you do folders, I don't know if you do folders, but if you do folders, you know, when people are kind of like searching around your page, like, I don't know, I would find it, me personally, really interesting if, like, I'm like, oh, hey, look at this. We can learn about all those kinds of things, and they're completely random. I love it. Thank you so much. I love the poem and the information and the work you did with it.
I love the facts that you include, but the speculation in the end is what gets me more than anything, because, you know, this isn't, you know, it's not my area of expertise, and you know, I have to respect the science, but you can't help but wonder, is somebody messing with us? How do they know that that arm goes with that leg, and those legs are part of that body? And, you know, it's like, I know that they go together and they find them together, and, you know, there's evidence that this was buried with this one, and this bone was always strong with that bone and everything. But, you know, when they put them together, they're like, oh, come on, really? You know, I mean, look at the T-Rex, the size of its head and those tiny arms. Who decided? Someone's messing with us. That can't be right, you know? There's a piece missing, you know? So someone stole the arms, you know? And the evidence says to the contrary, but, you know, you can't help but look at it and go, that's just nature fucking with us. Screwing with us. Yeah, that's the word.
I agree.
Yeah.
I totally agree. Who decided that this head, because it does look like a lion's body, but like I said, the face is sort of, it's got like the nose of a canine,
yeah.
but the teeth and the whiskers are cat-ish, but it, I don't know, the beady little eyes gives it a rat appearance, so It just, and if, when you look at them side by side, you wouldn't think one was a lion. And I so agree about poor T-Rex, big head, little arms. Who decided that? Yeah, like nature's joke on the poor guy. I don't know. Cool comment.
I can imagine what you know, generations from now, you know, when excavating the platypus, it's like that doesn't go together, you know?
Right. That's a good example because that strange looking critter and mega poisonous and. It's kind of different, but you don't want to mess with it.
Well, you know what the cool thing about this is what they, this was discovered sometime in the 70s, right? That's nothing, right? That's 50 years ago. And we're just uncovering this. And now, and you know, it wasn't until recently where they were like, you know what? We kind of think dinosaurs had fur. You know, and things are constantly changing. And constantly up for debate. So when you think about all these things that are yet to be discovered, or that was just discovered not too long ago, I mean it's really kind of crazy when you think about it. And you know, not next month because I went. I don't know where I went next month. I have so much stuff going on. The month after that, I have. I don't have it for next month yet, but the month after next, I have the Dodo, you know, and there's a whole speculation on that too, and how it was extinct, and you know, people don't mind things and record things, you know, and they don't realize that in the future they're like, oh well, this thing used to exist, and what was it really like, and yeah, it's just a really cool thing to think about. Really great poem, Deb. Thank you, and it sparked wonderful conversation. I don't know how much time you had, but I want to make sure before anything else happens that you plug for anything that you want to plug for at this time.
I do have to go because I want to eat before I'm going to pick up my son, but I have tomorrow, I have 10 o'clock. And I'm just calling it a little bit of this and a little bit of that because I just put a mega variety of pictures and I just want to look at them and get wherever you're inspired to go.
Melange.
And Raconteur, you could just, if you were able to call, give you a call and tell you what the pictures are. There's a whole bunch. I'm sure you have something that goes with one of them. I have everything from butterflies to dragons and landscapes and Patrick and SpongeBob, but on steroids. I know I don't know why I couldn't make myself throw it away, but it was the coolest kind of picture, and they look like thugs. Like Patrick has mega muscles and a wife beater T-shirt with a.
I have like, that.
Yeah, so that's one of them. And one of my favorites is Wednesday from the Addams Family, standing on a stool next to a camera that she set up to take pictures. But like I said, there's landscapes, there's constellations, there's an angel, there's a kitty. There's a pretty redhead. There's all kinds of really awesome choices. So I think one's the Milky Way, and it's a stunning picture. So, like, there's a whole bunch of choices, a tree, a ghost, an Indian.
I love her. I love her. I'm sorry. Oh, wait. I didn't add that. Go ahead.
Like I say, and I really like there's one where there's a dragon in it. About to come nose to nose with what I think is a sea lion. It's just adorable. Like, it doesn't have to be that he just bit his head off. They could be friends. So, like,
I love the like text pieces. The text pieces are really nice.
So there's a whole bunch of different choices. Even an amazing. It looks like a chessboard, and all the pieces are regular except the knights. And the horses that represent them are gorgeous. So, a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, that was that's the one I was saying. Mexican. I really liked the chess pieces. Okay.
Which one? Sorry.
The chess pieces. I really liked the chess pieces. They were really cool.
Yeah, I figured it wouldn't be easy to pick one because there's so many that you look at them and you're like, oh. But I kind of like them. I want to fire the muse and see what happens. So anyway. All right, I am going to go find something to eat. And I, another cool topic, Guy, and I'll have to do things. I'm going to have to thumb through them and make that folder because that's a good idea. There is a lot of cool stuff that I've written for the Down the Tubes. But, Sky, I know I wrote for Mac and Me. I can remember the photo of the pink Cadillac and the piece of bubble gum, but I've thumbed through my stuff. I can't find it anywhere. I mean, I went 2 years, I can't find it.
It's my fault. I should put things in a folder, too. You know what it is? It's because I'm for a while, I was like, I'm not going to do any more contests for these. It's too hard. I don't want to do it. But then I have this list that says, you know, film contests, and it has a lot of the ones that I've done. And I build these epic topics, and I usually put, like, the characters underneath, like character highlights, and I put all this stuff into the topic list. And then I'm like, I wish I had that to reference at some point. But then you take them down from the topics, and they're not there anymore, which is why I stopped doing character. Because I'm like, why am I spending all this time building? Because when I do those character highlights, that's a lot of time going through each character and putting the links there. And So I stopped doing it, and I just put up the trailer, and I'm just like, this is what it is. But and then I'm like, you know what? I kind of really want to do them and put that kind of work into it. And so that's why you might see me getting a little bit of ahead by going back to some of the things that I've done to pay homage to those people that have written and to kind of pay homage to that fandom. So you might see a lot of those till I get back caught up, if you will. So, but yeah, I know you do too.
Yeah, so like if you decide that you're going to stick with doing stuff like that, like I don't know, I assume that you keep them in that group, the thing you have, or in a draft. Maybe if you could.
Yeah, so if you
track the show was, like if I had a clue when the show was, like it can't possibly have been 3 years ago. So if I knew like sometime in the month of April, at least I would know where to look on my list. Some kind of notation.
I can do that. I can do that because I keep my folders of every show that I've ever done. I keep them in folders on my drive, and then I download the link with the folder that I build. So I can go back at any point, and I could tell you, oh, I did this show in November of 2021 because I have all my stuff in my folder on a drive with the things that I've built with it and the clips that I've built with it and the downloaded link of the show itself. So that's a great idea. I'm going to do that from now on. That I can give you an idea of when it is if I don't know where it is. Your storyboards, I have all the links. It's the other stuff I don't have anything. Because the storyboards, the special editions, I kept on my page because I love them so much so that I would have access to them at any time and I can just read them. But now I can with the show links that I do. So that's a great idea. I'm going to do that. Thank you, Deb.
Cool.
I didn't think of that.
If you happen to figure out when Mac and Me was, let me know so I can look again.
Okay. I think that's
right,
close. I think it closed, but yeah, okay. Just for your reference.
Oh, okay. Well, then, yeah. Anytime you do that, because often you just give me the link and I go and put it in, but you don't even have to do all that if you can give me a ballpark as to when I wrote it.
Awesome. Enjoy your dinner. I hope you're having something good.
Mac and cheese.
Are you having mac and
close.
Cheese?
No, I'm actually having a cheeseburger. But, yeah.
Oh,
ground beef cheeseburger. I'm going to go cook it because I'm starting to finally get hungry. I hadn't been hungry all day. But anyway, all right, you guys, love and respect. Like I said, cool topics, guys. See you later.
Thank you.
Slyly.
Have a good night, Deb. Thank you so much.
I've got a poem called Dinosaur you might like. It's a kiddie poem,
okay.
But it's perfect for what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So
the next clip I play, I'll drop that. Let me just, we're going to do Titus's poem, and because I dropped it right before Deb. I'm going to do Titus's poem,
cool.
Then I'm going to play another clip, and then while that's playing, I'll be able to navigate to download that link and to put it up there. So this is Titus's poem. So in my topic four, it says really random stuff, and some folks thought that meant it was like open poetry. So like JCA, Titus, and Wayne, it was a lot of folks, so it wasn't on them. It might have been the way that I worded it. But they put the links down, and I'm going to honor that, and I'm going to play their poems, and I'm so glad they participated in any form, so it's fine. And then I just reworded the rest of my down the tubes to be a little bit more clear, because the way that it was written, it did kind of seem that way. I could see where people would read that first line and be like, oh, it's open poetry. I did fix that. So this isn't one of our topics, but to be honest with you, the show is called Really Random Stuff, so we can do whatever we want here, right? So this is actually about, the Lark Descending, and it's by Titus Llewellyn, and he gave me a SoundCloud, which I love even more. And I'm going to go ahead and press play. Here we go.
The Lark Descending. As one harps in some downy meadow thrift, Hildin gives me a closer look amongst the family name allure the day. But one shift would disturb larks leading any angst to some place other than that first spot. High above a variety of smatterings, a slight declension from the lark, who would defiantly squat o'er numerous weeds, some seed scatterings whereby a dwindle of delight it did spark. In idle nooks a fledgling still would hide, for as long did not the wind shifts chime. Beyond the hedgerows from that sulky side, mark a forbidden roam one shall not climb, and not till daybreak did the lark display the height in which did feeling's paradigm did brighten not to frighten once again, where verbal tasks spray thought it might descend upon me, the meantime, songs fill the sky in turn to sorbent gain. But thence grounding itself, for quite a while, what then among the shrubs I behind still, to oversee the outcome, head out first, or so on first thoughts, where men do sit to hear each other groan, hear palsy shakes a few sad last grey hairs, where youth grows pale and spectre thin and dies, where but to think is to be full of sorrow and leaden-eyed eyes despairs, yet beauty can but keep its lustrous eyes. A few lone pines beyond them seeks to borrow. Time shall move no more than tomorrow can hail a lark to lift this spirit of mine now. A weight no one can say can no more fail. A lowly glide how can it not allow to lift all hope, to carry on the wind. An alpine reddish grin now faces tend, loom blends in well the open countryside, more peaceful to have sinned. A heap high mound would have it spend some time to have one's patience duly right. A lark descending will have time best swept away within a still life motion's plane. The moment has been spared for it has kept a reminder to find the trail. A true gain it speaks free time is to steal a flutter from where I sat again now willing soar. Transcending twilight twas a phantom lark. It was not a given utter from where I stood. I am more than sure descending whilst before then after dark.
Thank you. Excellent. Beautiful piece, Titus. And thank you so much for submitting it. I love this one. I really did. I owe to the nightingale, right? Inspired by the lark's descendant. An ode to the nightingale. And I think you did such a wonderful job. And, I mean, you always, I think, nail it in language. And there is a... I mean, this type of language and this type of writing, I read a lot. I read a lot of different poetry, and I read a lot of poetry from different times. So I can know that personally, I very much appreciate this type of lyrical poetry and these type of, you know, the language used. There's just this wonderful flow to it. And when you talk about, where was it? I mean, I think that I went through so many wells of emotion when you were reading this. I mean, I know there was this underlining and this center on hope and the idea of one moment. And when you look, when you're sitting outside and you see a lark descending, right? Or you see a nightingale descending, or you look at nature, you look at anything, and there's this whole world going on apart from you, but that you can observe and be part of. And I think when you stop and think about that, and you actually take a moment to observe the beauty in that, in the universe, I think you come into a realization of sorts as you wrote in this poem. There is a beauty in it. There is a hope. There is a fulfillment. But there's also, you touch on sorrow. I mean, you know, right where you say, and I really love this bit, where youth grows pale and specter thin and dies, where but to think it is to be full of sorrow and leaden eye despairs, yet beauty can but keep its lustrous eyes, a few lone pines beyond them seek. To borrow, and it makes you stop and think about time is fleeting, you know, the youth is not forever, and though things grow old and die, there is still a beauty in their life, and there's a beauty in that death as well, and I like how you don't shy from that. I love how you put it on there, I felt every wave of emotion rather than just focusing on one center of one emotion. And I liked that you did that. Really well done, as always. And Raconteur, what do you think?
Yeah, I love when he does things like you talk about the sadness. I mean, you know, that's part of what it is to be a nightingale. You know, in a sense, it's like he's picking his own topic, like if he was doing it down the tubes, is like this is his piece on the ode to the nightingale, and you know this is everything about the nightingale. He always, you know, it's funny, you know, he doesn't just conjure a picture of what he's writing about, but at the same time, at least in my warped mind, you know, Titus doesn't own a suit. He doesn't own clothes. He's dressed like a monk. He's got the one thing with a rope for a belt, and he writes with a quill. And you know, I mean that he conjures that image of the whole package. It's not just what he's writing about. There's the environment that he's in when he's writing too. That it feels like, you know, this is what he brings into the feelings that he evokes with the way that he writes, you know, the tone of his voice. It's like, okay, that sets a certain age expectation in my brain, and you know, I couldn't tell you, you know, heavy, thin, or whatever. It's just, you know, he's a disembodied voice almost in that sense. But you know, the rest of it, it's I don't know. He just amazing way that he conjures the images with what he writes, and it's not just what he's writing about too, but you know, it's the style that he writes in that also adds to the background and the texture of what he's writing about.
Yeah, and I think the word you're searching for is he's a bard.
Yes.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you with what you had said, yeah. Excellent addition. All right, so what I'm going to do is, I'm going to wait to plug our shows one more minute. I'll probably wait till Sweet Pea gets here, and then I'll have us all plug shows. I'm going to go ahead and play my next clip, and it's going to be the giant deer, of course, and that will give me time to bring up your poem, Dinosaur. It's called Dinosaur? I think I read that one.
Yeah.
I think I remember that one. I'd love to do it again, so that's fine.
I don't know that it has audio, but it's definitely, it's a quick one, and it's an easy read.
Okay, all right. I ain't scared. All right, here we go. The giant deer.
It was a typical autumn day in 2018 when two fishermen set off into the waters of Loch Nee in Northern Ireland. As they pulled up their net, they noticed something different among all their freshly caught fish. Something very large and very strange. It was a catch of epic and ancient proportions, one that had not been seen by human eyes for thousands of years. They had dragged up a beautifully preserved skull and antlers of Megaloceros giganteus, an extinct beast more commonly known as the Irish elk. Now, those two fishermen certainly weren't the first people to encounter Megaloceros. The fact is, the archaeological record is full of evidence that our ancestors lived alongside and interacted with these giant mammals for millennia. But what happened when they did interact, when humans met this megafauna? Did we perhaps love them to death? Or is it possible that the Megaloceros simply lived too large? Megaloceros was one of the largest members of the deer family ever to walk the earth. Despite being called the Irish elk, it's actually not very closely related to either of the two species known as elk today. Instead, its closest living relatives seem to be either the red deer or the fallow deer. But we actually know a great deal about what Megaloceros probably looked like in life because it inspired our human ancestors to immortalize it in art. It often appears in cave paintings dating to the late Pleistocene epoch, most famously in Lascaux and Cugnac caves of France. And we know these figures represent Megaloceros because of the one detail that the Ice Age artists took pains to capture, the animal's enormous antlers. Thanks to these depictions, we know a lot of other details about Megaloceros that otherwise we never would have known, like that it had dark stripes that contrasted with its pale head and neck. And attached to its shoulders was a distinctive hump, probably made of fat because it's not on its skeleton. And of course, there were the antlers. At their largest, the antlers of Megaloceros giganteus could reach 3.7 meters wide and weigh up to 45 kilograms. Even today, it holds the record for having the largest antlers of any deer species. Most experts believe that those giant features were used as a signal fire during mating season, which resulted in natural selection pressures for larger antlers. But the antlers weren't just prized by females, they may have also been important for humans in many parts of the world. Because these giant deer weren't only found in Ireland. Megaloceros actually lived throughout Europe, Northern Asia, and Northern Africa, and was used by different people in different ways. Many archaeological sites have been found with fragments of antlers that were modified by humans for their use. Take, for example, the site known as Wulan Mulan in Nay Mongol, China. The site dates back somewhere between 30,000 and 70,000 years ago, and there tools have been found that were made from the antlers of Megaloceros, including things like a hammer. Meanwhile, at sites in Spain and France from just over 30,000 years ago, we found more antler fragments that were modified by humans. And interestingly enough, these fragments appear to have been made from antlers that had been shed, having fallen off before regrowing again the next summer. This implies that humans may have scavenged and collected the antlers rather than just hunting the deer for them. And one of the most unique and, frankly, coolest artifacts made from Megaloceros material is an intricately carved dagger from around 7,000 years ago, recovered from a peat bog in Russia. But along with providing material for tools, Megaloceros may also have had a special, less tangible significance for humans. Some experts think that the frequent appearance of Megaloceros in cave art and in unusual archaeological contexts, like deep within caves, suggest that his antlers and bones could have been used in shamanistic religious rituals. So if these animals were so valuable to our species, then what happened to them? What went so wrong for Megaloceros? Well, as is the case with many extinctions, the precise cause or causes are still up for debate. The most popular hypothesis is known as the antler theory, and it places the blame on the very thing that made Megaloceros so fascinating and memorable. This idea was first suggested in 1830 by an Irish physician named John Hart, who thought that the massive size of the antlers must have required an equally massive amount of blood to grow and maintain. Once the antlers were shed, he thought, there would have been such a rush of blood back into the brain that males may have suffered seizures or strokes. Another idea from the same period was that the antlers were so big that Megaloceros would have constantly gotten tangled up in trees or bodies of water, causing them to either starve or drown. But most of these theories predate the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species in 1859, so they don't take into account the concepts of natural selection and adaptation. So by the 1930s, most of these early hypotheses were challenged using allometry, the study of the relationship between body size, shape, and growth rate. And these studies found that the antlers of Megaloceros grew in proportion with the rest of their bodies. So it's not like the headgear could have gotten too big for them to handle. But that doesn't mean that those huge features still weren't a big problem. In the 1990s, a new version of the antler theory emerged, and it's one that scientists actually agreed with. This model suggested that Megaloceros required a lot more nutrients than other megafauna, and that might have contributed to their downfall. Because of their antlers, Megaloceros would need a consistent supply of both calcium and phosphorus in order to restore the nutrients that they lost during growth and shedding. So any slight decline in their food supply would have had an enormous impact on their ability to survive. In addition, the amazing size of the antlers may have made sexual selection very exclusive. If only the males with the very largest antlers were being selected, then the species as a whole might have suffered a fatal drop in genetic diversity. But if Megaloceros had been so successful for thousands of years, then why would its antlers suddenly have become such a drag? As with so many things, the demise of the Megaloceros seems to be ultimately about timing. During their heyday in the Pleistocene epoch, they thrived in extremely cold environments, often living through periods of glaciation followed by slight warming. But in the late Pleistocene, as the climate started to change, Megaloceros populations became increasingly restricted to modern-day Russia. This is likely because the open grazing lands that had once sustained them were now turning into dense forests that the species struggled to survive in. And that brings the antler theory back into play. As the Pleistocene faded, Megaloceros, which was mainly a grazing species, lost its ideal environment for feeding. Populations began to dwindle, especially given that males needed a lot of nutrients to support their oversized headgear. And to make matters worse, the newly forested environment may have made it difficult for deer with larger antlers to get around, which may have also displaced some of the population. So perhaps, because of the combination of high sexual selection and the dwindling population of large antlered males, birth rates began to drop. But the death blow might have been the hunting habits of our own human ancestors, who likely had a taste for Megaloceros. For example, remains of Megaloceros from an early Holocene site in Russia show clear evidence of having been butchered. According to recent radiocarbon data from other remains found in Russia, Megaloceros had completely disappeared around 7,600 years ago. But since then, many more specimens have been discovered, including many that were fished out of Irish peat bogs, where the oxygen-poor environment kept the bones well-preserved. And it's not just the remains that have been preserved for all of these years. Depictions of Megaloceros in art and folklore throughout history have kept their memory alive as well. For example, Irish poet Seamus Heaney used the imagery of a Megaloceros skeleton being recovered from a bog as part of his series of poems about the famous bog bodies of Ireland. And Megaloceros also graces the Northern Irish coat of arms to this day, representing the natural environment of the country. Whether in body or spirit, the so-called Irish elk continues to capture our imaginations. And like our ancestors thousands of years ago, we continue to keep them alive through stories and art, reminders of the time when we met this majestic megafauna. Thanks to this month's Eontologist.
All right, awesome. And again, thank you, PBS, for your public service announcement. Or public broadcasting system, rather, right? I don't know. I think that's pretty cool. I don't have any poems about that yet, or may not, but at least we get to touch upon it. And, it's just cool to think about. So, one thing that they didn't mention in that video, which I thought was really cool, and if I were going to write a poem about this, the idea of Megaloceros literally being great horn. I just love when things like, when you look at names of like trees and flowers and you see all like their names, like their, you know, coined names or their easier names or their well-known names. I mean, they're just, like, my mom grows flowers in her garden, and I did a contest for it, but one of them is called the Cheesecake Iris. Now, is that its technical name? No, it's not. But the Cheesecake Iris, and it looks like a cheesecake. And I think it's so creative. So whenever I'm thinking about where I want to kind of go with poetry, and if it was like in a technical, setting like this, I would pretty run away rampant with the great horn and probably make something kind of crazy and fantastical because I tend to lend on fantasy. But I thought that was cool. All right, Jack, do you have any words that you want to share? Or? You don't have to, but if you want to, you don't have to.
I just pictured like candles on all the horns and making a chandelier.
Oh my god. Well, I guess if they were already like dead and I guess so. But not to hunt.
Well, that's
people eat deer, so, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, I know a couple of people that wouldn't mind getting that in their sights, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Poor Bambi. All right. So I remember reading this one, and I love this one, and I love it because of the ending, and I've read this one before. Now, is it safe to say that I can read this like I read children's poems to my godchildren?
Absolutely.
I don't want to demean your poem, but that's really what it is, right? So children's poetry.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely a sing-song. Okay. In the distance, hear that roar, look out, it's a dinosaur. You know, it's absolutely a sing-song. And unfortunately,
okay, well, I don't know
I
if we're going to do sing-song, but yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, are you ready?
Go for it.
Okay, I'm going to try to do you justice here, Rack. Dinosaur, sire, Rack, and Thor. In the distance, hear that roar? Look out, it's a dinosaur. Now you better watch your back, otherwise he might attack. 2 tons heavy, 12 feet tall, armored high, and teeth that maul. He certainly is an awesome sight, guaranteed to give you a fright. Wait a minute. There was no war. It's only Daddy at the door. I love that. I love it. It makes me smile. It makes me smile. I don't have a lot of my children's poetry up on AP. Now and again, I'll put it up there, but I don't have it up there for a long time. And I don't have my fear series out there at all because, you know, I would really like to and get it going. And one of my favorite things is sharing poetry with children because I think that just like cursive, you know, it's a dying art. And every year I go into the store, and don't worry, I'm going to loop back to the comment on your poem, don't worry. But every year I go into the store, and it feels like the poetry section is smaller and smaller, and it's filled, and not that I mind anthologies, but it's only filled with anthologies. And it's kind of like, what happens when you want to read the classics? What happens when you want to read one solid poet? Like, there's just not a lot of options when you go into a general bookstore. And for me, how do I solve that problem? Well, you teach children at a young age to love poetry. And it's easy to love because children naturally love nursery rhymes. But people don't say, you know, this is poetry, this is that, and this is this. And many children cling to it if they're introduced to it, but like they're not exposed enough, I don't think. So one thing that I love to do, as some people know that know me, I love to write children's poetry in any form that my godchildren like. So they like Pokemon? Well, I'm going to write Pokemon haiku. They like Plants vs. Zombie? Well, I'm going to write Plants vs. Zombie. They like the movie WALL-E? I'm going to write a story about WALL-E and the cockroach surviving the zombie apocalypse because they like zombies too, which I have, right? You write what they want to hear. And the good thing about writers is they can, you know, or parents or adults that are in children's lives, they can do that because they write poetry. So for me, this is beautiful because it creates a connection with the child. It might have been a connection with you and your child or a memory of your child. And maybe it not, but even so, I think it's just so, and it's playful, you know? It's like war. Like, who doesn't come in and try to scare their kids when they're little, like, war, and say, oh, I'm going to get you. It's a tickle monster, right? So I love that sweetness. I love that sweetness in this. And I love the wanting to pass on a connection with poetry with children. So wonderful wonderful write, Rack. And thanks for writing it.
Exactly what you thought. You know, I was showing my son how to rhyme, and you know, he loved dinosaurs, so I showed him how to incorporate like the description in the piece. And, you know, you can take it in a direction that's surprising in the end. And you're absolutely right, too, about, you know, with kids, it's you know, the topic kind of lends itself. You can write about, you know, anything in poetry, and if you make it adaptive and appealing, they're going to remember it. You know, it may be the cadence or the sing-songness of it, or it may just be that, you know, oh, you know, their favorite thing about, you know, a band was the name or something. So you know, that's what sticks with them. You totally take advantage of that.
Yeah. I remember when I did my show for Home Alone maybe two Christmases ago, my goddaughter was obsessed with that series at that time. And when I did the show for Home Alone, she was like, I want to write a poem for the show. But she didn't want it on the show, but she just wanted to write a poem for it. And I said, well, pick any scene you want in the whole movie. So she picked the spider scene, you know, where they put the spider on his face and he screams. That's the one she wanted. So I said, okay, so let's watch the film. And I told her, I said, so when you're watching the film, I want you to look at certain things in the scenes, maybe the wallpaper, maybe what they're saying or feeling, and you could write whatever you want in description of that. It doesn't have to rhyme, because poetry doesn't, you can do whatever you want. And she wrote a little thing about it, and it was so cute. So she has a little journal, and she writes poetry. And I mean, of course, I have all, like, the Robert Frost for, it's the real poems. It's just illustrated for children in a consumable way. And I just got one a little while ago. It's Emily Dickinson. And what they do is in the side tabs of each page, it's this great new series. I'm going to have to figure out what the name of it is so I can plug for it, because it is an amazing new series. At some point I'll get up and I'll get the books. But I have a few of them. And in the side tab, it bolds any words that are, like, archaic or difficult for children. And it will bold it, and then write on the same page with all the illustrations and the poem, it'll say what it means, right? So it'll say the definition right there. But then it will also ask different questions, like, about the poem. Like, it's just amazing. It's amazing. Her favorite is Robert Frost. So whenever we go buy a Robert Frost book, she'll be like, oh, I'll get Robert Frost, because that's her favorite. And then, of course, she knows that my favorite is Emily Dickinson, but I also really love Frost, too. He's my favorite as well. But she knows that if I say, what's Auntie's favorite poet, she'll say, Emily Dickinson. No. Or Edgar Allan Poe, but she's so funny. All right. Where are we? Okay, so we did that. I have a poem for, I don't think Wayne is calling. So he dropped a poem. I feel like Jay had a poem here, but I don't see one. Not like Jay Hatter, but like JCA. But I don't see him. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play Wayne, and then I'm going to play, we'll go from there. So we'll play Wayne, and then and then we'll go from there. All right, here we go.
This is called Kiss Me When I Get Back. Had some strange ways when young and wasted. Within my mind, I remember how freedom tasted. You're all I want, my reason to live. My way, I have nothing to lose or give. I just want to escape from the island today. Last chance, I finally found my way. Must get away from hell or high water. Tears are falling like rain, but much hotter. I'm alive and in danger of being dead. I want you, but I'm an animal in my head. It's my life. I'm a killer. I hate being that way. I still love you, but I walk alone today. Thou shalt not talk to me tomorrow. It never goes away. I live in sorrow. And I confess, as easy as it seems, it's no fun. Stop. Look to listen. There's nowhere to run. I'm somewhere between heaven and hell. Heaven's on fire. It's hotter than hell. And into the void and under the dome, I will be there. I'm coming home. Then.
So, I'm going to twist this like Rackfist did, right? Rack can twist anything. I just love it. And make it fit. And it's a talent, I think, Rack. I'm giving you a compliment. So, in the line, it's my life, I'm a killer. He's obviously linking it to the hypercarnivore, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go. There you go. There's the linkage. This is so fun. I feel like everybody's always dying in Rain's poems.
Well, he's a killer. He's a killer.
I know. Oh, my goodness. You know, I just want to escape from the island today, last chance. I finally found my way. It just kind of reminds me of someone who has been imprisoned on an island. What is that? In the Green Arrow, there's like this island prison, and I can't remember what it is, but I don't think it's just in the Green Arrow. I think it's in the DC universe in general, but there's like an island. I can't think of the name right now, but basically it's an island prison, and you go there to rot. I feel like he's just been put on this island, and he's escaping, and we all should be scared. So, anyway, it's like, I'm a killer. I hate being this way, but I still love you. But I'm going to walk alone because I'm a killer, and, I don't know. I think the scariest, in all honesty, right, in all seriousness, I think the scariest people that cause harm, I don't know, like killers or psychopaths or whatever, are people that, well, actually, it all entails. It's just not just one or two, because I think this is an umbrella for everyone. People that think that they're coming from a good place, that they're right? So they're convinced that they're the ones that are sane. They're the ones that, well, I love you. You know, but they're crazy. They're like, this is, I'm saving you. I'm saving you from the world, so I'm going to kill you. Like, that's just, it's awful. It's freaky and it's scary. And the way that you just do this so loose and at ease, and the way that you read is even at ease, and the way that the lines flow, it's just so natural. Like, I'm coming home. I'll be there in a little while. And here comes the serial killer. it's just normal in Wayne's voice and the way that he writes it. It's just, oh my gosh, it's a little scary, but a little fun too. I don't know. Everybody loves dark poetry, I think. Excellent poem. Thank you, Wayne. And thanks for the SoundCloud too, so I get to hear it in your voice. I think that matters a lot. I love hearing it in people's own voice. Rack, what do you think?
Yeah, you're making me nuts with the Green Arrow Island too, it's a question of, you know, he's recognizing his nature. He's like, you know, that this is who I am, so I must walk alone. So there's a sadness to it, but you know, at the same time, it's like, you know, well, you know, this is what you're signing up for if you're going to be around me. I'm a killer. You know, and that acknowledgement, you know, that there's something to be said about that too, about people that recognize their own nature, about things like that. You know, it's like, you know, sometimes they're cognizant enough. It's like, you know, well, I like you, so I'm going to stay away, because you know I'd be bad for you, and eventually, you know, you're going to wind up in my campfire. So you know, it's kind of cool. You know, but at the same time, it's like, you know, well, I'm giving up, and this is what to expect. This is what it's going to be eventually anyway, so I may as well just give into it and embrace it. I love that he writes like that. I love, you know, just about everybody around Wayne has wound up eviscerated in one way or another.
Awesome. So there is Stryker's Island, But I think the one I'm thinking about is something different. But there is Stryker's Island, right? And that's the name of Metropolis's largest prison facility, and it's named after the island in which it sits, which is Stryker's Island. I don't think it's that one that I'm thinking about, though. But we'll keep looking. We'll figure it out. Yeah, that's not the one I'm thinking of, but that is one of them. They're all on islands, right?
Amazon one was like Thermagora or something like that was the Amazon.
Oh.
Thermoscara.
I'd have to. Oh, yeah. Lian Yu.
Lian Yu, yes, I think that's right.
The Arrowverse. Okay. Well, we're going to have to figure out the Wonder Woman now that we're on a row. So Lian Yu was the one I'm thinking about in the Arrowverse. And then, of course, Stryker's Island, you know, that Metropolis. And then what do we got? What did you want to know? The Wonder Woman? I need to check my studio because I feel like Sweet said she was calling. So, Woman Island Prison. What did I say I was going to do? I said I was going to play my last clip. And then we've got another, we'll figure this out. I can't think, I don't know that one, but,
Thermoscara or something like that, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, but.
Or Themyscira or something.
Yeah, but that's Paradise Island. That's the whole island. That's not a prison. You're right, but that's the name of the island. You weren't talking about a prison. You were just talking about
the island.
You were just
yeah.
talking about the island. Okay. I thought you were talking about a prison. I'm like, I don't remember that. No, you're right. You're right. So I thought we were still talking about prisons. Like, I don't know about that one. Okay, so. What was I doing? Oh, yeah, The Time It Rained, right? The Time It Rained. And this is also just brought to you by PBS. Thank you for your public broadcast. let's see. And I haven't forgotten I owe you a tale of two cities. I will let you know after this one. All right, so Raining. Here we go. All right, this is our last clip, so let's enjoy.
Imagine a world so warm that the ocean feels like a hot tub. Huge volcanic eruptions have pumped the air full of globe-warming carbon dioxide. And with the continents locked together from pole to pole in the supercontinent of Pangaea, the world is hot, flat, and very, very dry. Early reptiles and mammal ancestors thrive in this sweltering land, dominating a landscape that's still struggling to recover from the Permian extinction. This is Earth. 250 million years ago, at the beginning of the Triassic period. But then, starting around 234 million years ago, the climate suddenly changed. For the wetter. The rains finally came to this hot, dry world, and then they stayed for 2 million years. This period of intense rain killed off many of the early reptiles and confused the heck out of geologists who found the flood deposits millions of years later. This time is known as the Carnian Pluvial Episode, and it set the stage for a new group of animals to take over the world, the dinosaurs. Evidence of just how hot and dry the world was at the start of the Triassic is trapped in the land beneath our feet. Rocks from that period are mostly swaths of red sandstone and soil deposits from dry woodlands with no sign of the coal swamps that had covered the world during much of the Permian. And one major reason that the world was so dry was the shape of Pangaea. With all the continents locked together, rain clouds couldn't move much past the coastlines, and there were no big mountain ranges to break up the low, arid land. Now, dinosaurs did exist in this dry post-Permian world, but they were still vying for their place among the early reptiles and reptile-like mammal ancestors. The dominant carnivores back then were the early Cruotarsans, a broad group of croc-like animals that included reptiles like pseudosuchians and phytosaurs. For example, there was Ornithosuchus, which had long hind legs and could actually stand up when it wanted to run, which I imagine would have been both awesome and terrifying to actually see. But even stranger than these were the rhynchosaurs, herbivores with parrot-like beaks and sometimes cheekbones to die for, all on a chubby lizard body. And although there were no true mammals, there were Dicynodonts, the closest things to them at the time. They're actually more closely related to us than, say, Dimetrodon, despite being scaly, four-legged creatures with bills and tusks. All of these fascinating creatures were widespread for most of the Triassic, with one species of Dicynodont called Lystrosaurus being so common all over the world that its fossils were actually used to help construct the idea of plate tectonics. But these animals, adapted as they were for life in a dry climate, were in for a big shakeup. Most of what we know about the history of climate comes from plant fossils and rock types. And in the early 1990s, two British geologists found rocks that didn't match the dry climate of the Triassic that they knew. Instead of finding red, slowly deposited sand, they found thick layers of river rocks, sediments from giant lakes, and evidence of coal swamps. All of these were signs of massive rainfall over the course of some 2 million years. But stranger still, these traces of a suddenly wet climate turned out to be everywhere, from England to the Americas to Israel and regions that were far apart at the time. That meant that the rise in rainfall must have been worldwide. Initially, other geologists were skeptical. Couldn't these rocks just be explained by a lot of big local floods? Well, over the next 2 decades, reports of more and more weird rocks kept trickling in, and they kept pointing to a world that was getting wetter and wetter. The rocks revealed coal deposits in Austria, traces of ancient lakes in Italy, wet soils in Utah, and giant rivers in China. And they all dated to the same window of time, between 232 and 234 million years ago. In time, this phenomenon came to be known as the Carnian Pluvial Episode, or CPE. The Carnian is the name of the geologic age within the Triassic when all this happened. And for what it's worth, I seriously thought about naming this episode the Chronicles of Carnia. But I didn't, because that would have been dumb. And pluvial means rain, and it rained a whole awful lot. For example, one estimate suggests that average annual rainfall in what's now Utah almost quadrupled, reaching a peak of 1,400 millimeters, or about 55 inches of rain a year. For context, that's how much a temperate rainforest gets today, like, say, in the Pacific Northwest. And this would have happened over and over and over and over and over again, all around the world. It was not one big flood. It was more like floods every year, all over the place, for 2 million years. And with all this rain, things were bound to change. And one of the biggest changes was a sudden abundance of dinosaurs. In rock dated to the start of the Carnian Pluvial episode, dinosaurs account for about 5% of the fossils of terrestrial vertebrates. But by the end, they make up more than 90% of those fossils. So what made the dinosaurs so suddenly successful? Were they better off than their competitors in this newly wet world? Or did other animals simply die, leaving them to rule the world by default? The key might not have been the rain itself, but what the rain brought with it: a proliferation of giant plants. During this time, we begin to see lots of large conifers and big coal-forming plants, like the primordial-looking Benedettales. And for herbivores, this change in food supply could have been a game-changer. For example, rhynchosaurs were abundant, but they were also short, and they couldn't stand on their hind legs to reach higher leaves. This would have been fine in a dry environment where plants tend to stay close to the ground. But in a wet forest, rhynchosaurs would only have been able to eat smaller plants or whatever leaves and fruit fell to the ground. Meanwhile, the Dicynodonts were herbivores too, but they didn't have teeth. And they also didn't use gastroliths, the rocks that some animals, like birds, swallow to help digest plant material. Without teeth or gastroliths, the Dicynodonts would have had a hard time eating anything fibrous like wood. And sure enough, fossils of Dicynodont poop from this time have been found to contain mostly soft ferns with only small amounts of wood. By comparison, some plant-eating dinosaurs, which both had teeth and used gastroliths, left us poop fossils that are up to 85% wood, which is a lot of fiber. So as the climate became wetter, soft small ferns were quickly replaced by tall woody conifers, which Dicynodonts and rhynchosaurs didn't eat. And without rhynchosaurs and Dicynodonts, then the carnivores, those Crurotarsans, would have lost a lot of their food supply. So maybe instead of being better adapted to this new environment, dinosaurs were just the only major group of reptiles left standing, or, you know, squatting. Even though we don't know exactly why the rain helped the dinosaurs, we do know that dinosaurs became a lot more abundant during the Carnian Pluvial episode, and that Dicynodonts, the rhynchosaurs, and many of the early Crurotarsans soon went extinct. Now there's still the question of what made it rain for 2 million years in the first place? Well, right before the rains came, some 235 million years ago, there was a huge burst of volcanic activity in Alaska and British Columbia. Today it's known as the Wrangellian eruptions. These eruptions lasted for more than 5 million years, churning out a layer of lava that got to be 6 kilometers thick and releasing enough CO2 to raise temperatures by about 3 to 10 degrees worldwide. And over a very long time, warmer temperatures can create a wetter climate because they can speed up the water cycle, driving more evaporation of surface water into the atmosphere, among other things. And in fact, because of this increase in atmospheric moisture, the CPE is also sometimes called the Carnian Humid episode. But for what it's worth, my personal favorite name for this episode is called the Wet Intermezzo, which I just think is delightful. So let's try to bring that term back, okay? Anyway, after about 1 million years of these eruptions, the atmosphere became so warm and wet that rain could finally reach even Pangaea's vast interior. Okay, but then how did it stop? Well, when carbon levels are really high for a really long time, our planet can be pretty good about getting some of the extra carbon back into the ground where it belongs. Plants take it in and store it in their tissues. Weathering and eroding rocks absorb it. and the oceans soak it up to form carbonate rocks like limestone. So as the Wrangellian eruption slowed down, the carbon cycle was eventually able to stabilize. Excess CO2 was reabsorbed from the atmosphere, and the CPE gradually came to an end. By the time the eruptions had completely ended 230 million years ago, the world had returned to a classically hot, dry Triassic climate that only ended when Pangaea began to break up. But even though the Carnian Pluvial episode was short, only 2 million years, its impacts on life were permanent. All that rainfall helped conifers spread and diversify, leading to the pine trees that we know today. And while the start of the Triassic may have been the land of weird croc-like things running around on their hind legs, by the time the rains ended, the world had fully entered the age of dinosaurs.
Awesome. I would have been ready down with a chronic of Carnia. I don't know. I really love that. I mean, as a huge fan of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I think that he should have went for it. I think that could have been a thing. I love that. It reminds me of that time that I did the show about the giant mushrooms. And the only reason why we have trees is because of the giant mushrooms. And it just makes you think, like, what, you know, this was the world back then. What is going to happen, like, 5 million years from now? Like, it's just crazy. It's just absolutely crazy. But I vote for Chronicles of Carnia. What do you think?
I'm down with that.
I thought that was really funny, actually.
It was. That's a cool clip.
Okay, so I have, she wrote what was inspired by it, but now I deleted it, so I don't have it. So I'm just going to read this one. She did link it to something, but I apologize because I can't remember. This is Semblances and Natures by Kay. Balsam firs and grains meet periwinkle wood dust and night blades. Conformity echoes, bustling seconds, tanned olive branches, thunderclouds, almost smoky inches of rain and haze. To touch, to feel, to taste the absorption of rain and pain, like a health lay, degrees of land, pure, dapples and magic. End poem. And it was for the rain, so it was right in the poem. So it's good. It is beautiful. So when you think about, what's this, like one, two, it's like four lines maybe. They're long lines, so maybe they could be broken up a little bit, but it's just so short. But when you think about the beauty and the impact, they really do. Like the balsam firs and grain neath periwinkle, it reminds me, periwinkle wood dust, and nice. It reminds me of paintings, right? So you have the balsam firs. And when you think of ingrained beneath, I think of personally the periwinkle sky, or you could say periwinkle wood dust. So you know when paintings are like kind of like the farther back you go in paintings, it's more blurred to give that that perspective of depth, and then you have those hazy colors. That's what it kind of reminds me of, and I really love that part about it. And then of course she has branches, thunderclouds, almost smoky inches of rain and haze. Again, that's lending to me a painting. It might be because I like painting and I like paintings in general, but that's what, like, this image is actually pretty cool. And I'm picturing these darker tones of the thunderclouds, but also overlaid with that lighter tone of the greens of the balsam firs, and then the purples that are coming in, the light, hazy purples that are coming in with that periwinkle. And I think those colors are pretty cool. And then, of course, to taste the absorption of rain and pain. I'm going to have to go back to my painting metaphor. You think about the canvas absorbing that, and you can take it any, the thing about this is you can take it as, well, it's a person, and the painting is the person, and they're absorbing the rain and the pain, and the rain, obviously, a metaphor for those darker things that fall. So, I mean, there's many ways you could kind of take it. I'm going to stick with my painting one because that's how I visualize it. But it's cool because I think that you can take it in many different platforms. Really well done. Rack, what do you think?
Oh, you know, when she said dappling, my mind went to painting as well. Because, you know, to me, that word, they're affiliated. So, but yeah, it was beautiful imagery, like she always does. And you know, her connection to nature comes out in a piece like this. And she ties in some lovely emotions as well. So, it's a beautiful piece.
Awesome. Thank you, Rack and Tor. And you know what? I'm just going to read the last one. And, well, let me send him a message and see if he plans on calling. So, you calling, bro? and then I can give you your much-awaited story. And keep an eye on, because I think Sweet might be calling. So as Rack and I were kind of chit-chatting before the show, and I was trying to tell him what I was doing today, and this is completely random, but I thought that I would tell you, Rack, and anybody who's listening, I found the best game. It is, I got it a little while ago, but I have had yet to have anybody play with me, so it's a commitment because it's Monopoly, but it's Dungeons and Dragons Monopoly. All right, so they're not houses, you know, like you there, and then there are dungeons that you have to go to, and all the they're not like everything is replaced with D&D terms, so there's no houses or hotels. And then all the sites are basically anything in D&D. So I got to play with my mom, who is 74, who has never played D&D in her life. And she's not that big of a fantasy person, but she likes Monopoly, so she kept on trying to relate it to Monopoly. And I've not really played Monopoly too much. I maybe played it like once when I was young, and I don't even really remember it. So she's sitting there trying to converse the rules to me in Monopoly terms, and I keep on caressing her. And then I get out the guy. She's like, what is this? I'm like, Ma, you're going to be the dwarf with the Warhammer. And she's like, what? Like, and I'm like, I want to be the archer. And my goddaughter, I let her pick first, but she picked the sorceress. So I said, you know, I said, Mom, I said, you can pick next. I'll pick last. And then she was like, I don't even want to pick. You can pick. So I said, okay, well, you're going to be the dwarf with the Warhammer, and I'm going to be the archer. So we're going on this game, and it was so much fun. And then at the end, and my goddaughter, she's like 8, so she doesn't know how to play, so she's learning too. And she just loved it, and she's doing math with money, and she loves D&D, so she was even more into it. And at one point, everything was bought up but the beholder, right? So we're trying to look and seeing. So I pull out the card, and I'm like, hey, guess what? We just fought this, because the last campaign we just did, we fought a beholder. Well, we ran away from the beholder. So she was like, yeah, I remember that. And it was so awesome. And my mom, who had the other two yellows, sections, wanted that card so bad, and she ended up landing on it out of so lucky, and bought up all that stuff. But it was really, really cool. It had, I mean, it was just a cool game. So, yeah. Anyway, that's what I was doing tonight. Well, actually, not tonight, but a lot of the day was playing Dungeons & Dragons Monopoly. I wanted to draw. There was a lich. My mom got the lich. She's like, what is a lich? And then my goddaughter chimes in, a witch who died. Come back. My mom's like, what are you teaching her? Now I can see it me. So, yeah. Anyway, it was really fun. I recommend the game. It was really cool.
That's awesome.
Finish it. But we took pictures of where we're at, and my goddaughter is killing us, absolutely annihilating us. I think I had to put three of my things up to, for mortgage just to pay her. it is what it is. But yeah, it was fun. All right. I think, I don't know if he's calling, so I'm going to read for him. So I'm going to read for him. So Hatter wrote for the Mega Lobster, so the one that we just did, the clip we just aired. So this is what he wrote. And as always, I tell them, I think this might be fiction, but I say in my topic list, fiction or reality. So here we go. This is Girls Giggle at What's Now Too Late by Jay Hatter. The tales of bigger things found in holes in spring, larger than hers today, tangled in the woods to play, shedding racks in gunny sacks, their pictures on the walls, painting faces in darkened places, trying to kill them all. Stripes are spotted, an uneven fit, Irish deer born upon the list, pulling wagons for green tree trolls, guarding treasures and stories told. Remember, size matters to those with hats. You just can't tell what's in his sack. Larger or smaller, shorter or taller, it's all about the rack. The girls giggle, what is now little, and that's a matter of fact. Global warming, climate change, smaller bucks, but what remains the same? With antlers the size of garbage cans, so large we can't understand. Used in love to bring the girls, or weapons to fight off flying squirrels. Deep inside the bogs they filled, lay at rest, the last one killed. Oh, it's dead. End poem. He went everywhere with this. He got a little cheeky, a little saucy, I think, at some point. But they did talk about the meeting, you know, habits, so I'm sure he held to that. You know, and then he brings in global warming and climate change and all these things and how the world is changing in itself as well. He got very cheeky and funny at some point, but then... And then he got like, and then he got kind of sad at the end, like this is the last one killed. And then of course, you know, he brings in, where was that? He starts talking about the tools, and I think, you know, part of that is yes, these things, there are tools made of these antlers and things such as these. So, this was all over the place with emotion. I thought it was kind of cool how he brought us to. I wouldn't think that you would, you know, if I was reading this, I wouldn't, well, not reading this, but if I were thinking about poetry, you know, having go from, you know, giggling and like, oh, he didn't just go there, that cheeky humor and that little bit of sauciness, but then you go down and then you're like, oh, now I'm kind of sad. To kind of like that whirlwind emotion, I think it was done well. And then at some point he, you know, this is called The Irish Elk, but he wrote, striped or spotted and uneven fit, Irish deer, born upon a list. So I like how he incorporated that little bit of fact in there and kind of switched it around a little bit for the poem, though. Really well done. I know Rack has a lot of to say about this. Let's keep it clean. And what do you think?
Well, I mean, my comments are all admiration. You know, nothing to do with anything. he's talking about natural selection, and he did it in a very polite and you know, presentable way. So, you know, it was an excellent way to mention it, because, you know, it was a factor, and even PBS said it. You know, well done. I mean, you know, perfectly handled, and you know, it would be a thing. You know, even if you were on the other end and you were hunting them, you'd be like, you know, well,
like real life hunters. They make a game of it. How many points was he? How, you know, how big was it? How big was this rack? You know, so you know, it was a very cool and thoughtful, contemplative piece, and it led to the you know, the eventual you know, thinning out of the herd, as it were. And you know, the last one, you know, he brings that up, and you know, this is how they became extinct. That was a natural way to end it.
Yeah, and he obviously watched the video, because you know it mentioned how, because you know, in mating, when you're thinking about they're drawn to the largest antlers, it's dimming down and closing in their gene pool, right? And they mentioned that, so I could definitely tell he watched. Thank you so much, Hatter, for taking the time and watching and learning something, and bringing us a poem that is accurate. And when I say cheeky, I did it in a fun way. I admire the way that he did it. But I'm like, oh, you meant this way. You know? But that was fun.
Size matters.
I was a little, when it comes to antlers, I was a little sad at the end. He brought me down a little bit. I was like, oh. Thank you, Hatter, so much. I do appreciate it. And I feel like now is a good time to start plugging. So I will let you go first. You're on next week, right? The 26th?
That's 2 weeks, isn't it?
Well, next week, I'm considering next week like not the next Tuesday, but the next Tuesday after that. So when I say, okay, like next Tuesday, I mean two Tuesdays from now. That's always confusing when people say that, don't you? Like not this last Tuesday, but next Tuesday, the 26th.
The last Tuesday of the month. At 10. Last Tuesday of the month at 10 on Team of Voices. It's going to be embroidery. Embroidered.
Do you want to elaborate on that at all, or you're good?
You know, I'm good with just the word right now. You know, it can take you in different directions, and it's a simple thought that really kind of lends itself to, you know, 20 different directions at the same time, so. I don't want to influence it one way or the other. Wherever it takes you, you know.
Okay. Awesome. And then I'm on a lot this week. So I am on this Tuesday, and it is Shutter Button Poetry with me. And you could bring any poem written to one of my Shutter Button contests. So you could either bring a poem that you already wrote, or you can write a new one. I have over 500 contests with 500 photos, over 500 photos. I really feel like that number is even, let me check that number, because I feel like that's even more than that at this point. Let's see. I have done, yeah, it is, 600. And 31. So there's 631 photos that you can choose from to write to or to bring and just share. That's it. No more. There's really not a lot of hard work in this one. And that's on at 8 p.m. on this Tuesday. And then I am on Thursday at a Poetic Slice, and it is my last show at Poetic Slice. And we are continuing Tron Legacy. It's on at 8 p.m. at Poetic Slice. If you would like more information about the topic, message me directly on how to participate. You can write to any of the themes, scenes, characters, and or quotes. Quotes, you can go even anywhere, even if off the topic, from the topic itself, as always. So Tuesdays and Thursdays, that's my next show. I do want to talk about our next Down the Tube show, and I used to do this all the time. I used to talk out what I would have my next month all ready to go. ants because these shows tend to require homework. I don't give you guys a lot of time. So we are featuring The Wind by Ray Bradbury. I'm a big Ray Bradbury fan. And he did, like, a lot of, like, they did a lot of radio adaptions. And I have the radio adaption in the link for you in the topic thing. You can listen to the story. It's really cool. I probably will be bringing it to the show to enjoy. So just keep that in mind in case you don't get to check it out. But it's a cool story. It is October, so I tried to pick something a little scary because it's Halloween month. So The Wind is a little bit sci-fi horror, if you will, you know, so it's a cool story. And then, of course, I have Little Apple of Death, and that's really cool. So it's a very poisonous tree with little tiny apples that will kill you. So you can check those out. And then we also have the Puka. So you can learn about the Puka from Monstrum PBS, talking about lore. So you can either go lore, you can go actual real-life nature with the trees, or you can go Ray Bradbury, The Wind, the story, which is a short story. It's really great. So that is next month on Down the Tubes, and I'm looking forward to that one, to be honest with you. I really love that short story. I think I've listened to it a few times now, and it's great. So that's about it. That's all I got. I'm guessing.
Awesome.
Sweet got lost. That's okay. Oh, I need to say my thank yous. I need to thank, let's see, Raconteur for being my right-hand man here. Let's see. I'd like to thank Titus, Deborah Lee, Raconteur, as I said, Kay, Hatter, and Wayne for all calling, submitting, participating, and being part of the show. I think you guys are awesome. And I don't know about you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying Killer Wayne.
Oh, I know, right? Crazy. You know what I find really crazy?
What's that?
I mean, it flew by really fast. I think it did.
Yes.
I don't know.
I had a good time.
Huh?
I had a good time.
Me too. Thanks for coming by and hanging out with me, even though I was, like, crazy busy. So busy. My goddaughter slept over last night and tonight, but she slept over last night, and she made a list of things that we have to do. And as we did them, she crossed them off. And she was very specific on that list. I just thought it was just absolutely brilliant. All right, so we are closing with Old Man Cannon. And I have to be honest with you, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about them after the song. So please stick around to hear a little bit about them because I lost my page that I had here. So enjoy. And I think this song is perfect because, I don't know, it reminds me of, like, a little bit of youthful, and I think that we brought a couple youthful pieces with us today. So, yeah. I hope you enjoy. There you go.
And I'm wiser and
Vancouver-based singer, producer, and multi-instrumentalist Jet Pace makes senses of life by creating art while producing and recording his music almost entirely alone. He layers live instrumentation along analog synths and ethereal vocals to paint stories and ask questions. After generating tens of millions of streams and building a devout audience, he continues to engage with his 2023 So Long Babylon EP network music group. Since emerging in 2012, Canyon has quietly captivated listeners everywhere. The 2014 Phantoms and Friends EP yielded the breakout title track, Phantoms and Friends, which amassed 16 million plus Spotify streams and counting. So you can still do things by yourself. That's a very self-motivated person right there, doing all that work by himself. And he sounds great doing it. So I hope you guys enjoyed. I will see you guys. Well, we'll be back on air with Team of Voices tomorrow night with Deb. And I will see you guys on Tuesday with Shutter Button. Have a good night.